Hello, I'm Jeremy Hunt, Chairman of Veterans on Duty, and we are back with another episode in our series, Beyond the Call, our video series, where we sit down with different leaders, veterans, policymakers, even some elected officials, talking about their story, talking about some of them who have served, why they decided to serve, and really getting into, even nowadays, some of the policy issues that they care about. But today, I have the very special privilege of interviewing Garrett Exner, who is on our board at Veterans on Duty. He's also an adjunct fellow at Hudson Institute. He's executive director of the Public Interest Fellowship. But what's very cool is that he's also a former Marine Special Operations Officer who has deployed all over the world. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to dive into his story, some of his deployments. And then he's also going to tell a little bit about his inspiration to serve, how his sister was on the 52nd floor of Tower 2 on 9/11, and what that meant and how that inspired him. Stay tuned and let's dive in. Garrett Exner, this is awesome. I'm so excited to have you here. You are MARSOC officer, Marine Special Operations officer. You've deployed to East Africa. You deployed to even Iraq several times and all over. And then now you're executive director of the Public Interest Fellowship. I want to talk about that. And of course, you're on the board of Veterans on Duty. And of course, we are a policy advocacy organization focused on building a military that is strong, secure, and focused. And also policies that make America safe, strong, and free. That's what we're all about. And it's been an honor being on the board with you. So I'm excited to just hear a little more of your story so everyone at home can hear a little bit about what inspired you to serve.
Well, first, I'm excited to be here. I get to just hang out with one of my friends, somebody I admire and aspire to be more like, which is you. And get to have a conversation, which is probably the most relaxed interview I'll probably ever have. More anxiety. In other places.
I hope you're ready. It's going to be really serious in there.
But thanks for having me on. Yeah. I had like a pretty standard military career. And then I talked to other people in the military and realized it's different for every person. And maybe mine was a little unique in some ways. I joined in 2005, right after college. I was set on doing that. Throughout college, my sister was on the 52nd floor of Tower 2, the World Trade Center, when the planes hit. She got out alive, but that day knelt down in my dorm room at college and said, "Hey, God, I'm committing to this. I'm going to do everything I can to make sure something like this doesn't happen again." And I think, God's been with me and helped me figure that out through my career. But joined in 2005, did some time as an artillery officer, 2 deployments to Iraq, and then went on a Marine Expeditionary Float that took me to Yemen, of all places. Sana'a, Yemen, and that was my first touch point with SOF, and just said, these guys are way cooler. They're doing cooler things, and I want to be a part of it. Came over to SOF, came over to MARSOC in 2011, went through assessment and selection, and then stayed with them until 2019, until I got out.
Wow. And I want to kind of back up a little bit. So when you were in college, had you previously decided you wanted to serve in the military, or was it really that moment, 9/11, with your sister being in the tower that you made that decision?
I wanted to be in the military from as far back as I can remember, running around in the woods with a stick for a gun, envisioning myself being in the military. I think that in my mind was always going to be in the Army. I had talked to an Army recruiter. And my mom was pressuring me, just go to college, join the Army afterwards. I had signed up for Army ROTC at that time in college. I wasn't really a big fan of the program that I was in, but then it's my first month of college when September 11th happens. My sister's in there for most of that day. I'm assuming she's dead, watching the buildings collapse.
When did you finally hear from her?
I think the next day my mom called. She called, she was crying, and she had a secretary at the time. She put her secretary on her, and she was like, your sister's safe. She got out. She had walked home barefoot, covered in dirt and stuff, and didn't have a phone. Like, her cell phone was in the building. My brother was down in Texas. I was in college in Texas. My brother was there. So we went to a movie that day, just tried to like get our mind off of it, try to cope with the idea that, somebody had just killed my sister. And for me, it was, this is the moment I said, I got whatever I do, I can't just join the Army just to join the Army. I need to join to fight, and I need to be the most forward-leading unit I can. So when I went to a Marine recruiter And he sent me away and was like, no, you're not ready to join the Marine Corps, which is like a recruitment shtick, right? It's like a thing that they do. He spotted me. He was like, this guy wants in. I'm going to tell him no, and he'll want in more. That was a moment that I was like, I'm done with Army ROTC. I'm joining the Marine Corps because I got to fight, and these guys are going to fight, all because of that one day in September.
Wow. And when you joined the Marine Corps, how long was it until you ended up going into the soft community, and how did that work out?
I joined 2005. In 2011, January 2011, I went through assessment and selection. I think I got off the float with the Marine Expeditionary Unit, 15th MEU. I got off that float in December. I had been working with a Special Operations Task Force, and in January, I was at assessment and selection. Like, there's no, I'm fully committed to this. I had been working with a group of SEALs who had run that task force, and I asked for advice, and they said, just don't have a backup plan. You know, if you go in without any backup plan, then you won't let yourself fail. And they were exactly right. You know, just go in. And if I fail at this, like, I don't know what my Marine Corps career looks like if I have a career at that point. So it's, you know, full throttle. Let's spin the throttle. Let's go.
I mean, all right. So I know you can't tell us everything, but at least tell us some of the stories of your deployments, some things that are unclassed that you can share with us. Any experiences that you feel like really shaped your thinking on a lot of the policy issues that we talk about today?
Yeah, absolutely. The stories that I think I hold to or think about most are always like time with the boys, the best part about being in the Marine Corps, best part of being in soft is the people that you get to work with. The problem with telling a story like that here is that, especially for like a veteran community, people don't want to hear training stories. They want to hear the deployment stories. They want to hear the action stories. So I'll try to tell the, you know, one that I can keep as unclassed as possible. In about somewhere in the window of 2013 to 2015, on one of the deployments to North Africa, we were going to move some guys from one Arabic-speaking country to another country. But to do that, they needed to get out of their country into the country that bordered theirs. I was going to meet them there. We rented them an apartment in this place in a rural area, which is a little sketch as it was. Me and another Marine went down there, met them, chatted them up, made sure they were good. Then I had to work and coordinate with the embassies of the country we were in, the country we were going to go take them to, and get them visas and take them over there so we could train them. And the idea is we'll bring them back to their country and they'll go kill terrorists and, like, you know, hopefully do good things on behalf of American taxpayers. In the process of scrambling around, super stressed out, my wife at this point is home. We have two little kids. They're super close in age. They're both babies. My wife did not sign up to be a stay-at-home mom. She is a Marine. She's, you know, she's pretty motivated. She's a wonderful lady, more talented than me. She should probably be on the board of VOD instead of me. But she was home taking care of two babies and diapers, you know, struggling. She had left her job the Marine Corps to do this. And now I'm on deployment. I'm now driving around in this country. Nobody speaks English. The one guy I have, the former SOF officer who's from an Arabic country, is there to help me out. His visa gets denied for this third country. So he's like, hey, I can't go with you. So now I got a little over a dozen dudes that don't speak any English, staying in an apartment. And I'm trying to coordinate with these. I'm meeting with ambassadors to try to get these visas approved and driving back, trying to keep these guys corralled. And my wife calls me in the middle of this, and she puts the phone up. It's like on speakerphone, and my kids are just screaming their heads off in the back of the car. And she was like, "You did this to me. You did this to me. I had a career." And she's like, "You have to listen to this too." I'm like driving to meet these guys, and probably the highest stress moment of my military career. And in the moment, I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I can't hang up on her, right? She divorced me. So I just got to sit here and listen to these kids cry and, like, prepare myself mentally to go get these 12 dudes onto a plane and then fly with them to where we needed to go. Eventually, she just hung up the phone and, like, you know, let me out of that torture session. And we get on a plane and we fly to this other country. And when we land there, I go through customs. I went through really quick. I sit down on the other side. There's, like, a little restaurant. And I'm waiting for them to come out of the airport. We're going to get on another plane, fly somewhere else. And I'm like, I'm feeling pretty good. We just accomplished this mission. As soon as these guys come through, we're going to start training. It'll be good. And I get to fly back to Europe and, like, hands off at this point. I'm going to turn them over to a team. I actually had a beer as I was relaxed. I was like, I get to enjoy a beer. It was like celebration. And then they never came out. Like, an hour goes by, hour and a half goes by, they never come out. And I have to start going around the airport I have to use French at this time because the people are speaking Arabic or French, and find a way to get back into customs, which they don't let me back into, and find these gentlemen who are from a whole nother country. And eventually they let me back there, and I realize that they've all been detained. And now they take my passport and they're about to detain me. I'm with another guy named Scott, this wonderful Deke. And he looks over at me and he goes, Garrett, we're about to go to SEER school real quick. He could sense that like we're being pulled to, we're going to get interrogated too. We're going to be pulled in these detention rooms. So before they come back to me, after they took my passport away, I grab my cell phone and I call the defense attaché in that country. And I'm just like, hey, I think I'm about to get arrested. The rest of the guys are bringing here. Can you get a hold of somebody in the police force or the military to like get me out of here? And they came back, they took our phones, and then they separated Scott and I. And I actually saw the guys we were bringing in walk past through like a glass window. And one of them like gives me a thumbs up and like a nod, like, I haven't told them anything. And I'm like, no, just tell them the truth, you know? When they came in, the police officers came in, they're like, who are these guys? That guy says he's a school teacher. This guy says he's a construction worker. It was like the YMCA cast, you know, of jobs is now like being brought into the country with all like weird passports and visas. And I'm like, if you could just tell them I said to tell the truth and we'll be out of this. Finally, the call came through from the embassy, like let us all out of there. We got on our flight later on that night. It was fine. I tell those two stories, and you asked about like how that relates to the policy world now, is that in both those scenarios, sometimes you just have to trust that like it's going to work out. And there's one thing, you know, from SOFT that I try to promote here, particularly at the Public Interest Fellowship or anything I'm doing in DC, is that calm breeds calm. And if I stay calm and I just, you know, get through, whether it's two babies screaming at me on the phone and I got important work I got to do too, sometimes you just got to sit there and you just got to endure what you're going through and know that it's going to come out. You know, my military career started with a prayer. Prayers kind of carried me through most everything I do in life. And in those moments, sometimes you just got to sit there and be like, God's going to get me out of this. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to go forward. But I can't stress out. I got to stay calm. And I hope I've carried that through.
Well, and while you were a Marine Corps Special Operations Officer doing that type of work, how often did you work with SEALs, with the Green Berets? What did that kind of cross-branch coordination look like?
Yeah, so a lot, actually. A lot more than I think most people would think. One of my deployments, when we showed up in Africa, the team that was there was SFODA before us, turned over them. Great bunch of guys, wonderful to work with, did really the best prep work I could have asked for on that mission. A little bit less than a year later, I was in a different part of Africa, and this time in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. We have a split team, 6 to 8 SEALs and 6 to 8 Marine Raiders doing different things, working with police and local forces there. And me and a senior chief SEAL, right, running that mission. So there's a lot of cross-pollination between the elements, particularly as you get further up the ladder and SOF, and you get into more joint stuff, you get a lot of different touch points with different entities. And McRaven had this big thing of like, we're all SOF, but there's many flavors. Like we're all kind of the same thing. We're all ice cream, but there's many flavors of ice cream. I believe that. I think that's not how our mission sets should go, but I think it's generally true. It's all the same type of guys and gals that wanted to serve their nation and be at the pointy end of the spear, as far forward as they could be.
That's awesome, man. So, you know, getting back to the States and, you know, you finish out your time in the military and you start looking into the policy world. What are those kind of, you know, veterans on duty, we talk a lot about the importance of building up a strong military as a deterrent. And if we have to, you know, the military should be used to deter, fight, and win our nation's wars. And we talk about that a lot and the importance of making sure that our military stays strong. How does that kind of influence a lot of the policy research that you've done in your various positions around since you've been out of the military?
I would say it's twofold, right? The first part of it is, it goes back to what I said earlier, of the, you know, being among the best and brightest of our nation in the military is humbling. It's an honor. It's something that I carry with me everywhere I go, the burden of I want to do the best for them. I think VOD gives us both the opportunity to do that, right? To serve them. We want them to have the best military. The young men and women who are 17, 18 years old, 19 years old, joining the military. That's the majority of our military, the young people who believe in what they're doing. The military needs to be protected and fueled to do the right things so that they have the best experience. The experience that you and I had, where we had you know, time in service that we look back on fondly, they should have that, right? They shouldn't look back on their time after they serve and say, why did I do that, right? They should be very proud of it. And the military does need to be protected from some of the bad influences that can come in. That's the first part. The second part is that there's a, you know, constantly shifting policy debate in DC over the size of the military, what the military should be involved in. You and I and everyone at VOD were proponents of strength, right? We have the world's strongest, best military ever, and we want to keep it that way. That requires investment, requires, you know, leadership at home and abroad. The military needs to lead. I think this administration is doing a great job of that. And I think it's reflected in recruitment numbers. People are, that's where they want to serve. In a nation and forward administration that honors military service, that doesn't abandon them in different places. That's really the primary thing that I take with those two things from my time at VOD, and what I hope VOD, you know, gets to do going forward.
Yeah. And you work a lot with the next generation. You work a lot with the young people who care about these issues, the Public Interest Fellowship. Tell us a little bit about that and how is it, what are some of the concerns that you see, and also what are the things that are heartening for you when you look at the next generation?
So TPIF broadly is an organization meant to educate and cultivate the next generation of leaders who believe in the same core principles that we believe in here at VUD and other places, you know, free markets, individual liberty, strong American foreign policy, the kind of pillars that made this country the greatest nation the world has ever seen. We're trying to, as those people are looking to come work in DC, we're trying to give them opportunities to educate them, connect them to a network of other people who share those same values so that they can do the good work of their country. They can serve the public interest better. We don't ask anything of them other than, hey, just, you know, study the foundational text, Federalist Papers, things like that, before they go do their work. So they know, why is this country so great? And we need to protect how great this country is. The parts that worry me as I look at younger generations is that there's been a lot of negative information pushed their way, whether it's in schools, whether that's in, you know, public schools or things like that, or it's at in colleges and universities.
Negative information about America.
About what we stand for and what this country is built on. This is a country that is built around a concept of freedom. And many people are somehow siding with countries and organizations that do not give a damn about freedom. You know, we have college students right now on campuses that are supporting a terrorist organization, a brutal terrorist organization. How our university system got so bad is beyond me. I don't know how this happened. But I'm glad that organizations like VOD, like TPIF, the one that I run, and a number of others that are here in DC and across the nation are trying to solve some of these problems and just give young people the access and the information to understand why we're so lucky to be in this nation.
Yeah, absolutely. Kind of zooming out a little bit, you know, we look at the rise of the Chinese Communist Party, obviously, is a pacing threat. We have Russia, obviously, invading Ukraine, Iran, North Korea, all these various threats in different parts of the world. And we know we're in a dangerous time. For you, what should be the focus of our military right now as we prepare to hopefully deter war with these aggressors? But if we need to fight and win.
I mean, you said it, China up front. China is the main threat. That is the top dog that we need to be worried about, because they want to displace the United States. They want to supplant us as the world's leader, and we can't let it happen. That's number one. There's a growing kind of mix of authoritarian regimes that are all coordinating together. Russia's in that. I actually put Iran slightly above Russia in kind of threats to America, mainly because Iran has shown, and they have, you know, through Hamas, have an American held hostage right now. They want to kill Americans. They're regularly engaged in the business of killing Americans. So I actually put them next. And then North Korea is probably fourth on that list. But all of them are working together. They're trading technologies and information and resources, all meant to destroy the kind of Western view of the world, which is one based on individual liberty and freedom, democracy. That's the biggest threat. And we need to understand that this is existential. Their rise is existential to the United States. The military kind of is at the forefront of this, but I think culturally there's a lot of work to be done to get ourselves prepared to engage in that fight.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you talked about the concerns on college campuses, and we have a lot of, you know, young people who watch, you know, this video series and who care about their country and are considering potentially serving.
What is your message to them? Why should young people nowadays consider serving? And what is the reason they should raise their right hand and swear an oath to our Constitution?
You know, one thing is just a concept of giving back. We've been given this great gift of a country. It didn't come for free, right? Somebody, there a lot of right across the river from Arlington, a lot of people that gave up their lives so that, you know, you and I get to live in this free country, that my kids get to grow up in a free country. So there's a part of it that's giving back, right? There's a second part of this, which is it's going to make you a better person. Service makes you a better person. It's the best part of life. It's the most rewarding part of life is service, whether that's to your family, your friends, to your nation, right? Is to serve other people. And doing it will make you grow and mature in ways that you probably didn't know that you had in you. That's what I would tell to young people. The person I was when I joined and the person that I, 14 years later when I came out the other end, they're different people. The internal workings are maybe the same, or maybe my core beliefs are the same. My faith grew more than I ever thought it was. I was a believer before. I'm 10 times more coming out the other side of military service. The third part about this, and maybe this is a curveball and maybe you won't get from everywhere, is that particularly for young men and women who are looking for adventure, joining the military is so much fun, right? It is wildly fun. And the amount of responsibility that you get as an 18, 19, 20-year-old kid, right? You're still a kid in many ways and they're going to give you a tank to drive or a huge piece of artillery to fire. They're going to give you, C4 that you can build into something that's going to blow doors off of a house. And you're going to run around in the woods with your friends and shoot guns. It is so much fun. And I have a million stories of being with the best friends I've ever had in the world, traveling around the world, times when it's just one, two, three of us. And we were laughing so hard it hurts, because how could we possibly be in this situation? But the military is going to give you the opportunity to be in those, and you're going to grow from it. And the best part about it is, in all that fun, you're serving your nation. It blows my mind that people don't want to join the military. There's like a hesitancy to do it. It's awesome.
And I definitely agree that the adventure component of it, I'm excited that we're starting to see a lot of that, even in the Army ads that are coming now with the new administration. We're seeing that the ads are focused on that and showing people that, hey, this is, it's fun, you're at service. And I think that's why we're seeing some of those recruitment numbers finally start to bounce
back. Doing tough things makes you better, right? If you want to be better in your life or whatever, better prepare yourself for a career, to be to run a family, to run a home. The military is the best place to do it. It's going to challenge you and it's going to make you tougher. People knew this for a long time. Some reason in the last 20, 30 years, we've forgotten that the way to get better is to do tough things, progressively harder things, and you will grow through that. The military offers you the opportunity and they're going to pay you to do it. Why not jump on that?
So one tradition we have on the show is that we always have a challenge coin. We ask our guests to bring a challenge coin that means something to you, and hopefully have a little story behind it. So I want to see which one you brought today.
Yeah, I did bring one. I've never been a big coin guy. So for the beginning of my career, it was not, definitely not chasing coins or anything like that. So I actually brought one from when I got out of the military, because as a young soft officer, there was a time in about 2011, 2012, 2013, when there was a young guy out there putting out videos named Matt Best, and he partnered with Evan Hafer, and they founded a company called Black Rifle Coffee. And, our team, when we were deployed, we would watch dozens of his video, of Matt Best videos. And I loved seeing them find success, right? They're veterans that found success, particularly soft veterans that found success, massive success afterwards, kind of being true who they are, taking care of veterans. They do a ton of philanthropic work. Around the time that Black Rifle went public, I got to meet Evan Hafer, and he gave me a coin. So I have Evan Hafer's coin here. It says Evan. It's got the Chaos Bear on it. And it relates to what I was talking about earlier of chaos is always going to take place. Calm breeds calm. Gotta stay calm at all times. And I love that he put that on his own coin. So that's the one I brought in today.
Awesome, awesome. And that's not the only Black Rifle Coffee thing you have with us
today. It's not, yeah. In my office, I have a fridge. It is regularly stocked with Black Rifle Coffee drinks.
Nice.
Middle of the day, charge up and get going. So I'm a big fan of them and everything they've been doing.
Very cool. Very much approve. Well, I appreciate you being here with us. I appreciate you being on the board. I appreciate all your contributions to the issues that we care about, making sure that we have a military that is strong, that's focused, that's lethal. That's something that Veterans on Duty, we talk about quite a bit. And we're also building a nationwide grassroots movement of veterans who care about these issues. And as we often say, our service didn't end when we took off our uniform. And you're someone who embodies that. And so I just appreciate your service and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Here at Veterans on Duty, we are a policy advocacy organization focused on making sure our military is strong, lethal, and focused. All of that, of course, is about making sure America is safe, strong, and free. Those are the values that we hold dear, Vets on Duty, and that's why we're gonna be sitting down with different leaders, veterans, policymakers, even some elected officials in our Beyond the Call video series. Stay tuned and join us.